Hello and welcome everyone to the Nations of Charlemagne. We are going to be concluding the Nations of Charlemagne series with six episodes on the French Revolution, or rather three episodes on the French Revolution and its aftermath. Today is the first of a three-part episode, three lectures over 3 days, and I hope you enjoy it. Just before I go, before I sort of proceed with the lecture and the agenda for today, I just want to point out that as this is technically one episode or one continuous sort of train of thought on my end. If you are so inclined to send a super chat, or I do send and receive any super chats in the ensuing stream, I will read them at the end of Saturday's stream, all in one go. So I'm just going to be keeping these quite short, and then there'll be a discussion at the end of the last stream. So that's on Saturday. The first one today is on the fall of the monarchy from 1789 until 1792. Tomorrow's will be on the Reign of Terror. I'll be starting off talking about the September massacres and ending with Babeuf's conspiracy of equals. And then, of course, on Saturday, I will be talking about Napoleonic France, and not necessarily the battles, but how Napoleon transformed France. That's not to say, Pelham or Whitestreak, you can't send a super chat this evening. Simply, I will read it out on Saturday. So, yes, send super chats, everyone. I will read them. I'll just get around to reading them as a whole and discuss the topic in total on Saturday, if that's all right. Of course, before coming to this lecture, there are already various episodes. If you want to learn about French absolutism, there's a lecture on that. If you want to know about the final days of the Ancien Regime before we get to the last couple of years before the summoning of the Estates General, the episode Ancien Regime goes right up until about 1787, 1788. So do go and watch that. Nevertheless, for people who aren't going to rewatch those episodes, I'll quickly recap what is going on before we arrive at the convening of the Estates General. Before I do that, I just want to point out today is Bastille Day. I thought it was a very appropriate topic for today, discussing Bastille Day on Bastille Day. Nevertheless, I find it fascinating in terms of a element of the modern French psyche that they do continue to celebrate Bastille Day of all days. Of course, Bastille Day, whilst on the one hand it allowed the revolution to continue, it also marked the beginning of revolutionary violence and insurrection, mutiny, all of the things that will continue to escalate and worsen as the French Revolution reaches a bloody crescendo around the year 1794. And I think it's quite incredible the gall of it was Léon Gambetta in 1878 who brought back the celebrations of the Bastille Day after the fall of Patrice Macmahon's presidency and the pseudo sort of monarchical presidency we have right at the beginning of the Third Republic. It's around this time in the 1870s and the 1880s that France tries to fully enmesh themselves in the original founding myth of the French Revolution. In addition to that, also bring in La Marseillaise as the national anthem, because everyone seems to forget that after the original phase of the revolution, the celebration of the Bastille Day, effectively insurrection, and the singing of La Marseillaise fell into abeyance purposefully as a result of the various regimes that came into power. And all of these things were only brought back in the 1870s and the 1880s to fulfill a very specific political niche, the re-emergence of the French Republic in the form of the French Third Republic. Nevertheless, that's a little sort of a prologue on Bastille Day, now getting into the actual matter of this evening. When of course, Louis XVI inherits the throne in 1774, and it is remarkable that Louis XVI is a good man, a decent king, placed in an incredibly precarious situation by historical circumstances that were outside of his control. He was only 18 when he became king, and it had virtually no impact on the administration of France before. The reign of Louis XV was an ongoing disaster, ultimately, for the French monarchy. It looked as if by around the year 1740, the French monarchy had reached a height. It was able to reverse some of the losses in the late reign of Louis XV, sorry, Louis XIV, the disaster of the Spanish War of Succession. And then after the Glory of Fontenoy, after it looked as if France was being able to seriously expand its borders. It had formed an alliance with Spain. It was dominant in various parts of Italy, and it still had a major colonial empire. All of this goes away when France loses the Seven Years' War and enters a long period of protracted disaster. And nevertheless, rather than allow this to negatively impact the French regime, most of the petty bourgeoisie and the intellectuals are now moving away from the founding principles of divine right monarchy and Catholicism. They are now entering into a period of basically nihilism and cynicism. I don't think anything quite encapsulates that, like the general degeneracy around the court of Louis XV towards the end, and also the rise of various notorious figures, such as the Marquis de Sade. Nevertheless, Louis XV tried to bring in belated measures to affirm the state of French absolutism, whilst it looked like the monarchy of France was entering a period of protracted decline. This is the time of Catherine the Great. This is the time of Joseph II. It is the time of Frederick the Great of Prussia. All of these great monarchs who are transforming the natures of their state in line with the ideas of enlightened despotism, cameralism. Whilst embracing Enlightenment ideas, they're also embracing the notion of royal autocracy. And this is something that France really fails to do. And many of the intellectuals in France, like Turgot, are enamored with thinkers such as Montesquieu, who are taking their cue from Great Britain and, of course, the radical Whig trajectory of Great Britain in the form of the United States of America. Nevertheless, despite all of these ideas, Louis XV begins to try and crack down on the various institutions which challenge his authority. There's a remarkable session of the Paris Parlement in 1766 called the Flagellation Session, whereupon the king arrives and gets the parliament to affirm, "I am the king by divine right, you shall not turn into a British-style parliamentary monarchy." And this is done, you know, the Paris Parliament is a very ancient institution, and you have the idea of the lit de justice, the forceful registration of the acts, the idea that the Parlement never becomes a legislature for the French nation. Nevertheless, by this time, not just the Paris Parlement, but all of the various parliaments throughout France are becoming intractable in terms of their defense of the various privileged interests of the various groups. And in response to this, from 1770 to 1774, Mapu, one of the ministers of Louis XV, attempts to abolish the parliaments entirely and spearhead this idea of French absolutist autocracy. When Louis XVI comes in 1774, this is what Tocqueville discusses as the benign monarchy, how ultimately inoffensive various aspects of the French monarchy were. They weren't this continuous state of oppressive regimes. Even things such as the medieval punishments that were railed at in the introduction of the guillotine, various measures against cruel and unusual punishment were already abolished before the revolution happened in 1788. And the arrival of Louis XVI is seen essentially as a bit of a French spring, this lessening of the tyrannical and despotic governance, and also the corrupt and failed governance of Louis XV. One of these things, of course, is try and abolish the corvée as well. But despite this, despite the sort of moderate reforming zeal, and again, Louis XVI is immediately advised, such as figures like Turgot, who become great reformers in terms of free markets later, which is going to have a knock-on effect. So he surrounded himself very early on with people who are enamored of the Enlightenment. They are friends of Voltaire. And in spite of this, when trying to place some of these policies before the Paris Parlement, which is just restored on the basis of this new idea of a enlightened king who isn't going to rule in spite of the various institutions of the land, this is the reminder that the deputies give the king when he tries to abolish the corvée in 1776. The personal service of the clergy, i.e. the first estate, is to fulfill all the functions related to education, religious observance, and to contribute to the relief of the unfortunate through its arms. The noble, the second estate, dedicates his blood to the defence of the state and assists the sovereign with his counsel. The last class of the nation, which cannot render such distinguished service to the state, i.e. the third estate, fulfills its obligations through taxes, industry, and physical labour. So this is the basis of the idea of the states. All of them provide one particular service to the French society at that time, the society which is later characterized as the Ancien Régime, as the old regime. And it's into this that we're seeing a major financial crisis rock France. We've already had an attempt by Necker and now an attempt by Collomb to come in and try and mend the situation of French finances after decades of abuse. And of course, Louis XIV participates by supporting the American revolutionaries during the American War of Independence, which has just come to an end in 1883. And by 1783. And by 1787, Collomb and Louis are trying to contrive of new ways to raise various forms of revenue. And the problem is that in the system of French absolutism, there is a fundamental legitimate lack in the sense that so much of the power vested in the king is vested in the idea of the king's person, the ability of the king to cajole, demand, and force the various institutions of the land, the various estates, to bend to his will. There isn't a constitutional mechanism yet in France which just allows for the king to rule like an autocrat in the way that it's commonly and rather superficially described as in France, as an absolute monarchy. So this is something that should be understood, that the king is ultimately facing a crisis which was the making of his great-great-grandfather, Louis XIV, that in order to build this system of French absolutism, the machinery of government, which was there to supposed to facilitate the rule of the country, participation in the government by the nobles, by the clergy, the estates general, etc., all of these elements have been shunted aside, and they haven't been called, in the case of the estates general, they haven't been called since 1614, so over 170 years. And all of this is to make the French monarchy appear absolute, appear supreme, not having to lean on these various institutions and governments and the idea of falling back on the nobles to help in the governance of the state. There was a brief thaw in this just at the end of the reign of Louis XIV when a group of reformers around Fénelon, a bishop in opposition to Bossuet and the Duke of Burgundy, appeared as if they were going to try and transform the nature of the French monarchy. And of course, this doesn't happen. So Louis XVI inherits this system of French absolutism, and he also inherits its defects. And now he has to try and find a way to allow for a fundamental change in the nature of the estates and the privileges afforded to these various groups. Because in bringing the nobility into this new role, where essentially they eschewed feudalism to serve hand on foot as the king's courtiers in Versailles, the king had to confirm their rights. Now he's attacking their rights. And this essentially opens up a radical situation in France where you have a group of nobles who are supportive of their rights at all costs. And on the other hand, you have a group of nobles who are increasingly enamored with the ideas of the French Revolution, the ideas of Voltaire, and to a much more radical extent, the ideas of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And these people are so polar apart in terms of what they achieve, the king enters into a situation in which there is no clear majority for either side. There is complete political impasse. And this is the situation the king finds himself when he revives an old institution under the aegis of Collomb, the idea of the Assembly of Notables. Essentially, what is the idea of the Assembly of Notables? It was supposed to bring back this idea, this pre-Richelieu idea. Of course, Richelieu is one of the great proponents of French absolutism during the reign of Louis XIII, over a century ago. It's to bring back the idea of curia regis, the king's council. Higher nobles, clergymen, and judges from all across the land are there to help the king implement his proposals before sending them back to the established institutions of France, the largest one being the Paris Parlement, to force through these measures to ameliorate the financial settlement in France. And this doesn't go very well at all. Collomb's proposals include a tax reform, which would have taxed the value of land. And of course, the nobility are horrified by the idea that they're going to be taxed on the value of their land. Not only is Collomb dismissed by the king, but Collomb is actually temporarily banished and he is sent over to London. Now, what does Louis XVI do in this situation? I think so much has been made of Louis XVI's lack of intelligence or imagination. I think on occasion, it's quite evident that the king is able to demonstrate a considerable amount of political flair. So upon banishing Collomb, disassociating himself with Collomb, Louis XVI then brings in Bishop Brienne, the leader of the anti-Calonne faction in the French Assembly of Notables, his nominal opponent to bring in the king's tax reforms. And Brienne is also an ally of Turgot. He's a friend of Voltaire, has a correspondence with him. And it should also be noted that in terms of Louis XVI's sense of realpolitik, bringing in his opponent effectively to be his minister, Louis XVI also believes this man a bishop and later archbishop and a contender to be the Archbishop of France. He believes him to be an atheist. Nevertheless, he comes in, and the assembly under Brienne agrees to the principle of reform, the reform of the various provincial assemblies, the transmission specifically of corvée labour. Corvée is forced labour in France, where members of the Third Estate could be compelled essentially to serve in various capacities other than just taxation. So, for example, building roads, etc., or other forms of manual labour. Of course, this wasn't very beneficial to the king, who wasn't embarking on any grand building schemes. So the idea was trying to transmit that form of service of the Third Estate corvée into money tax. And again, there is a radical section of the assembly, as previously intimated, that suggests that the king's reforms don't go far enough, and they, as a body of only the nobles of France, are not a national body, and that such matters pertaining to the affairs of the entire nation and reform of the nation on this scale should be handled by an assembly of the nation. Of course, they allude to the idea of an Estates General, but already at this moment, if we're talking about figures like Lafayette, the hero of the American Revolution from the French side, and the wily Mirabeau, they are talking about something more akin to Jean-Jacques Rousseau's general will. They are not talking in the sense of just bringing in the Estates General as it existed in 1614. They're looking for something far more radical. With the implicit backing for some of the king's reforms, Brienne was able to go back to the Paris Parlement with the intention of having all of these edicts registered, which ostensibly was the job of the Paris Parlement. Nevertheless, the king now believed that he had some support, so he went even further with the Parliament. He tried to introduce various duties, a stamp tax, which the British government had failed to implement effectively in the American colonies before the revolution out there. The abolition of various customs, tolls, barriers, which divided the various provinces in France, and of course bring back the idea of a general land tax. And this was more or less used as a bargaining chip rather than something the king wanted to sincerely put through, because he was prepared to bargain with that on the idea that the Parliament would loan him money, essentially give him a blank check to do what he wanted with the nation's finance. And whenever the king felt essentially that the members were threatening, you know, that they're going to maintain their privileges at all cost. This is the interesting idea that the nobles are now threatening the idea of an Estates General. Now, why would the summoning of an Estates General from members of the Paris Parlement be a threat? And it'll be interesting actually to point out the subtle irony in the nobles calling for this in a moment. Now, the Estates General hadn't been called since 1614. I've already mentioned that. But why hadn't it been called since 1614? Well, it was called during the minority of Louis XIII, and this was at a point where Louis XIII was at his lowest in terms of authority. Richelieu hadn't yet come in and tried to radically transform the nature of the French monarchy. But pivotally, the continual summoning of the Estates General is associated with one of the worst epochs in French history in terms of the state of the monarchy, which is the period between 1560 and 1600, which people who watch this channel be aware, the French Wars of Religion. Mary de Medici and the last Valois monarchs continually held Estates Generals, and they became increasingly hostile to the monarchy and radical. In fact, one of the longest lasting Estates General, that of the 1588 all the way to 1593, was established solely to try and elect a king in opposition to who would later become Henry IV, the Bourbon dynasty founder. So the Estates General summoning it has a record of directly threatening royal authority. And of course, that's going to be very prescient, isn't it, for our discussion. But nevertheless, that is the historical attitude of the King of France. It is a surrender of that authority to this body, which has an incredibly dodgy track record. And rather than augmenting royal power, this will be seen as the last desperate throw of the dice to try and get through these reforms at the risk of undermining your kingdom, which of course is what the case is. So now the king is in feud with his parliament, And this has now become an issue of sovereignty. The king tries to force the registration of these edicts through this idea of lit de justice. He goes to the measure of taking them away from Paris, where there's a huge amount of support for them, summoning the Parliament of Versailles, and then when they wouldn't be compliant in Versailles, going even further afield in the city of Troyes, appearing at the assembly whilst it was settled in Troyes on a hunting trip just to come and visit, sitting in the council in person and trying to compel the various nobles to register the implementation of his financial edict. And when his cousin Philippe d'Orléans, the father who would later become Louis-Philippe of France, resists it in defense of his own royal privileges as the Prince of the Blood of France. And in response, the king signs Lettre de Cachet, which arrest all of the faction which have just tried to oppose the king and his faction. So the king is having to rely on increasingly desperate measures to try and cajole the various nobles to register the edicts of his various tax reforms. And ultimately, the king believes he has to circumvent Parliament, anything before summoning the Estates General. So there are various legal officials who go to the king and say, oh, we need to bring back institutions dating from the 13th century, from the reign of Saint Louis, in order to completely circumvent all of the parliaments just to get through these acts. If anything, that should demonstrate the total hostility and the complete political impasse, the paralyzed nature of the French constitution on the eve of the summoning of the Estates General. And of course, these plans are discovered. The press in Paris goes wild with rumors about this. Parliamentary representatives from Brittany come to France. They form the Breton Club, radical sort of opposition to the king. And later this would coalesce into the Jacobin Club. It's also during this time, with the idea that the king is actually prepared to circumvent the Paris Parlement, that we have a major outbreak of violence across France. And of course, there is now the possibility of famine in Paris. This is due to a combination of factors. Turgot's free market reforms, meaning grain is leaving France rather than staying in France. A few bad harvests from 1786, 1787. And of course, the expansion of the French population to around 25 to 30 million by 1789, without a industrial revolution to actually revolutionize the nature of farming in France at that time, still using what we would consider medieval methods. So all of this exacerbates the problem where you have a hungry population, you have a desperate financial situation, and you have a king who is unable to solve this through constitutional means. So Brienne is dismissed, and Necker, as a attempt to assuage members of the Third Estate, of course, Necker is Swiss, he's a commoner, he's a banker of some incredible international renown. And when you have someone like Necker in your government, you can essentially rely on him to improve the credit rating of the French nation just by having him as your controller general of finances, such as the international reputation of Jacques Necker at this time. Nevertheless, the king is incredibly weak, and Necker demands full access to the royal council, the position of prime minister, in addition to being controller general of finances. And of course, what does Necker is also sympathetic to these various ideas. So the king bites the bullet and accepts the inevitability of summoning the Estates General in January of 1789. Nevertheless, before then, Necker spends the autumn and the winter inspecting granaries, banning the export of wheat to forestall a grain crisis, negotiating loans, grain supplies with foreign powers, namely the Netherlands. And again, with Necker's, in terms of like what the idea was and what the impetus of the edict is, and how you can say limited Louis XVI's aims were in terms of trying to restrict this and not allow the Estates General to become a riotous or a revolutionary assembly. The edict of 1789 proclaimed, "We have need of a concourse of our faithful subjects to assist us to surmount all the difficulties we find relative to the state of our finances. These great motives have resolved us to convoke the assembly of all the estates of all the provinces under our authority." And the king also emphasizes the reform of abuses, the redress of grievances, the so-called cahier de doléances. And the intention was to reform and strengthen the monarchy as paramount, with a narrow focus on fiscal reform against the possible revolutionary potential of such a body. And in order to guarantee this, again, there was very little in terms of wiggle room on how the body would be constituted. The idea was to resurrect it as it was back in 1614, an ancient composition where there would be voting by orders. So the first two estates, the clergy and the nobility, would be able to outvote the third estate in any serious measure. From January to May, Delegates were elected from each estate, though many members of the clergy and nobility defected to the third estate, around a third of the members of the third estate, consisting of nobles, while members of the clergy, such as the Abbe Sears, were also elected members of the third estate. Perhaps the most notable noble to become elected as a member of the third estate was, of course, the Comte de Mirabeau. Sears, of course, is renowned for his, in preparation for the convening of the Estates General, the pamphlet, What is the Third Estate? In this pamphlet, Sears argues that the third estate constitutes the closest thing France has to a complete nation within itself, as opposed to a constitutional dead weight, as was the interpretation of many members of the third estate beforehand. It should also be noted that one of Louis XIV's most effective policies in limiting the power of the French nobility and also in bringing in new blood from the third estate was the creation of the noblesse de robe, essentially what we would have now in terms of the equivalent English House of Lords, which is entering into the political system through purchase. And then, of course, we have the creation of venal holdings or office through purchase and then inheritance, etc., etc., etc. That way, Louis XIV was able to prevent the old established nobility monopolizing various positions of actual governance. So, for example, going out through the provinces and controlling the généralité and allowing members of the third estate to buy their way in the system. But by the time we arrive at 1789, there has been an aristocratic backlash and they are revolting against this. And this idea of this specific class of the noblesse de robe controlling all of these administrative posts is no longer the case. And so the third estate is perhaps more alienated now than it was, say, for example, at the height of a catastrophe like the middle stages and the late stages of the Spanish War of Succession nearly 100 years ago. Sears stated that the people wanted genuine representatives in the Estates General, and of course, equal representation, if not again equal to the other orders, then perhaps voting by head, voting by population, not voting by social rank. And of course, this leads to the very famous saying of Sears, what is the third estate? Everything. What has it been hitherto? Nothing. What does it desire to be? Something. And in response to these proposals, Necker, of course, who is somewhat sympathetic, negotiates that there should be more representatives to the third estate. But again, this is nothing more than the token point, because if you still have voting by orders, then it doesn't matter how many members an individual order has, they can still be outvoted by the other two. Nevertheless, there were tentative ways of trying to sate and cajole the third estate into effectively buying into the system. The Estates General is finally summoned in Versailles on the 5th of May, 1789. I've got a lovely painting by Coudert on the left-hand side here. And in order, again, to emphasize how much the king wanted to control the nature of this organization, we have these lavish series of protocols organized by Barenton, the keeper of the seals, these beautiful costumes, as you can see here. The king in pride of place, all of this is convened in a little enclave just outside of Versailles, adjoining the palace. All of this is to impress on the delegates the majesty and power of the French monarchy. And combined with this, combined with the dazzle them and stun them approach, we also have this maintenance of strict etiquette for the assembly. Whilst Necker ensured that the agenda remained very focused on the issue of finances. And this is where we have this, I would say, a remarkable about turn. Previously, up until now, the nobles had resisted any movement against the king when it came to infringing on their privileges. However, now the nobility are faced, literally face to face in this image, with representatives of the third estate. Many are their own number who have defected and joined in this potentially revolutionary organization, as Sears would like you to believe. And now they actually have a body other than the king who could seriously threaten their privileges, not from above, not from below. So from the beginning, we have a tacit alliance between the remnants of the upper two orders and the king. And this is why, going back into my earlier points about why members of the nobility threatened the king, saying we need to convene the Estates General. In the prevailing case, I believe that unless it was coming from a figure like Mirabeau or Lafayette, This was an empty threat. It was simply to demonstrate to the king that, you know, we're not going to give up our ancient privileges. Are you really going to summon this body, which is going to undermine your authority and possibly wreak revolution and havoc in the country? And of course, Louis XVI, again, you can say that without the benefit of hindsight at that time, it could have been calling the nobility's bluff and forcing them in a position where they have to rely on the king in this tacit alliance. On the other hand, you can say it was a political calculation by the king, aligning himself with Necker, that catastrophically backfired. Nevertheless, I think it's fair to understand that the king wasn't just a passive observer allowing the momentum of the revolution to continue unabated, that there was definitely political formula in terms of what Louis XVI was trying to achieve. Mirabeau, and of course this almost instantly causes an impasse between the various estates as they break off into these various political alliances. Mirabeau and Sears attempted to work around this impasse by inviting members of the other states to join them as a common as opposed to orders, dividing the idea of separate bodies. And it should also be noted in terms of the king's own freedom of action and the king's mind that the Dauphin, Louis-Joseph, died, I think it's on the early June of 1789. So right in the middle of the proceedings, the king is also faced with the death of his heir. I know this also sounds harsh to point out, but this wasn't such a great crisis for the monarchy. Louis had another son who will become the Dauphin Louis and briefly Louis XVII. And of course, infant mortality being what it was in France, this wasn't an uncommon occurrence. Nevertheless, the king is also having to deal with this family tragedy, in addition to having to deal with this political crisis and an increasingly emboldened and audacious third estate who are brimming with all these revolutionary ideas. And after attempting to circumvent the estates and create the new revolutionary system in France through common rather than separate bodies, bypassing the constitution of the Estates General, on the 17th of June, the Commons declares themselves to be a national assembly. In response, and again, a national assembly, a committee, an organization of all the people, representative of the general will, as opposed to representing this narrow constitutional mindset which the king's ministers are trying to impose on this body. In response, the king appeared in the assembly itself to demand that the estates reconvene as they were legally constituted, close the meeting hall of what had now become the National Assembly, whereby the assembly declared that our rights had been infringed. They met in the nearby tennis court, and it was there that you see on this image on the right by David under Bailey, who is later becomes the mayor of Paris. Bailey declares that we shall not be dissolved until a constitution for France is established, and this is the famous tennis court oath. Another attempt to compel the assembly back into orders failed, and this was the royal session. And by the 9th of July, the assembly had declared themselves to be a constituent assembly, essentially a body outfitted to prepare the way for a new constitution of France, independent of the authority of the Estates General. Effectively, by the 9th of July, the Estates General had been superseded and the king had, it would seem now, been temporarily overcome by events. Now, there was an atmosphere of sympathy and enthusiasm for the members of the Third Estate. And this had been growing since the passing of the edict which originally convened the Estates General. While the Estates met in Versailles, the popular press kept Parisians abreast of developments, meetings, resolutions of the Assembly in Versailles. Nowhere was this more evident than in the intellectual salon of Philippe the Duc d'Orléans, who was also the Grand Master of the Orient of French Freemasonry at the Palais Royal. With the tacit approval of the Duke's entourage, some of the crowds gathered in the palace would actually spring in prison grenadiers accused of being supportive to the assembly even before the storming of the Bastille. Meanwhile, bread prices were soaring and bakers were often accused of hoarding grain. And if they were accused, invariably some of them were lynched. And you have combined with this a extreme summer heat in 1789, a hungry population and a religiously zealous and a revolutionary sort of religiosity associated with them to create a zealous population in Paris. Paris in 1789 during the summer was effectively a tinderbox. All it required was a match, and here it comes. Frustrated with Necker's failure to control the estates, Louis XVI sacked Necker and reconstituted his old council with nobles who were supposedly ultra-royalists, such as Bretouille and de Beaujolais, while royal troops were concentrated on the outskirts of Paris, many of whom were Swiss and German. Again, the fear about the the members of the Royal Army, the officer corps, that having French troops fire on French citizens would lead to mutiny. And this is ever present throughout the remaining 3 years. Fearing that the king was about to launch a coup with the amassing of all these troops on the border and the dismissal of Necker, who was essentially considered sympathetic to the Third Estate, Camille Desmoulins, a journalist and author of Les France Libère, played on the fear of a second St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. And of course, St. Bartholomew's massacre, all the Protestants are invited in to a wedding, the city gates are sealed, and there is a massacre ensues of all the high-ranking Protestant nobles. Those who aren't killed are captured, like who would later become King Henry IV of France, who is now Henry of Navarre. There is a precedent set in France, and playing on these fears, Desmoulins is able to incite demonstrations across Paris, and they take for their patrons and their defenders, they create effigies of Necker and, of course, effigies of the Duc d'Orléans, who is creating his rival court, his intellectual salon in the Palais Royal. An attempt to disperse a crowd with cavalry on the Place de la Concorde fails, and after then, Royalist regiments retreat to the outskirts of Paris. Over the next few days, Parisians attacked custom posts, they seized shipments of grain and weapons, and this represents more than anything a fundamental failure in the leadership from the Paris garrison. And of course, it's during this time also that members of the French Guard, the permanent Paris garrison, some contingents are defecting, in some cases whole platoons are going over to the mutineers and what would later be reorganized as the Paris militia. And the regiment commanders are failing to commit their men in any situation, paralyzed by the fear that they're going to be mutinous and turn on them. Such a dramatic abdication of responsibility among the officers of the Royal Army led to the revolutionaries creating their own Paris militia. And this is instantly identifiable. Desmoulins had chosen the colour of green, but the Paris militia ultimately decides on cockades of red and blue, the colours of the city of Paris. The militia of Paris had already stormed the Hôtel des Invalides, the main military hospital which had been established by Louis XIV, without any major resistance, and they acquired there a significant cache of weapons, and then headed to capture the gunpowder barrels at the old fortress of the Bastille. The Bastille, of course, was an old medieval fortress. It's the closest thing that France had to a Tower of London, that and possibly the Temple as well. Nevertheless, I mean, just the absurdity, if you were to transpose this into the English setting, of the Tower of London being stormed and also casually demolished in the way that it was in the French Revolution. At this point, in terms of selecting the Bastille as some sort of symbolic instrument of royalist oppression, the Bastille had seven prisoners. The Marquis de Sade, it should be noted, had transferred out of the Bastille some 10 days earlier. And in fact, proposals were already underway for demolishing the fortress because it had superseded any military or tactical significance, as would be proved by the storming. And so the design was to create it into a public space. So that again should indicate how little the regime itself actually thought of the Bastille beyond its historical significance to them, which this is, of course, the, before the era of conservation as we know it now. So we have the gunpowder, which has been brought into France and stored in the Bastille. And there is a tentative symbolic significance to attacking the Bastille. So the revolutionaries make it their next target. As the crowd arrives outside, negotiations for the transfer of the gunpowder begin with Launay, the governor. And this is going to be supposedly peaceful. In an attempt to de-escalate the situation, the cannon from the ramparts were withdrawn, only to be falsely interpreted by the crowd below as loading the cannons in preparation to fire. The outer courtyard was stormed, and a party from the crowd scaled the walls and successfully cut the chains of the old medieval drawbridge to the Bastille, causing the crowd to enter and be fired on by the members of the garrison. The mob repeatedly refused to respond to the garrison calls for ceasefire. The mob, now reinforced by more mutineers from the Paris garrison, convinced Launay to capitulate. At first, he threatened that all of his men would leave unmolested, otherwise he would personally explode the gunpowder stock in the fortress. Nevertheless, the French mutineers do not agree to this. He was ignored, capitulated anyway, only to be seized, beaten, and stabbed to death, while the governor of the Hôtel de Ville, the city hall of Paris, Flesselles, was also accused of treachery, by the mob and murdered. And both the heads of Launay and de Flesselles were paraded around Paris as traitors. So again, in terms of commemorating this day every the 14th of July, because this is the intensification of French violence brought on by an atmosphere of paranoia and mutiny, it's not France's best moment, to be sure. All the while this is happening, 5,000 men, royalist troops, were camped at the Château de Mar and did nothing while the insurrection took place. Thereafter, the petty bourgeoisie militia of Paris, or the sans-culottes, distinguished by their wearing of the pantalon, or the long trousers, to distinguish themselves from the silk knee breeches or culottes of the nobility. These sans-culottes play a, and of course derived mainly from the artisan classes of Paris, play a major role in continuing the revolution. The events in Paris took several hours to reach Versailles, but the king from the 15th, upon hearing this, convinced he could not count on the loyalty of the army and dispersed the garrisons. Lafayette assumed control of the militia, later the National Guard. The Parisian delegates of the Third Estate established a Paris interim commune under the leadership of Jean Sylvain Belli. Necker was recalled by the king some 2 days later, again in another attempt to sate the bloodlust of the revolutionaries in Paris. The royalist faction, who had been briefly in the ascendancy for 2 days from the 12th to the 14th of July, began fleeing France almost immediately to become the first émigrés. The most prominent of the first émigrés was the Comte d'Artois, who would later become King Charles X, the king's brother, who was the leader of the ultra-royalist faction and a key ally of Marie Antoinette, and he fled to Savoy along with his two sons. And just like that, a large amount of the royalist cause in France was actually lost to the king, intensifying what we're going to talk about continuously throughout this, which is the king's ever-increasing state of isolation. The fears of the first émigrés were soon justified when the storming of the Bastille saw the creation of various mirror institutions and militias, communes, throughout all the rest of France, leading to the great fear whereby chateaus across France were ransacked and the title deeds to them burned. And this was substantiated by the residue of the same fear that led to Desmoulins declaring an impending second St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, the constant fear of aristocratic noble reprisals. Within a week, the nobility of France had been cowed, attacked, and some of his late leaders exiled and killed. Perhaps the most visceral example of this was the murder of Douai, Necker's successor as the Controller General of Finances. He was captured and taken to the Hôtel de Ville. Ignoring the entreaties of Bailly and Lafayette, the mob attempted to lynch him, only to end up beheading him. As a demonstration of the new ascendancy of Lafayette and the National Guard, the Bastille, as a symbolic monument of oppression for the revolutionaries, was dismantled, and the key to the Bastille was offered as a gift to Lafayette's former military comrade out in America, and now President George Washington. The triumph of the revolutionaries was confirmed when Lafayette presented a modified revolutionary cockade to Louis XVI. The red and blue of Paris was now separated by the Bourbon white to represent the monarchy and its new relationship with the revolutionaries, ushering in a constitutional period which would last for the next 3 years. Right. Just give me a second. The newly empowered National Assembly, now the Provisional Legislature of France, was quick to exploit the king's weakness to pass a series of radical reforms, passed with little comment or debate on a wave of revolutionary enthusiasm. The reforms of the 4th of August of 1789 nominally abolished feudalism in France, and with it its ancient seigneurial privileges afforded to nobility, such as manorial courts, the corvée, venal holdings, and the privileges of the clergy, including the abolition of the tithe, the suppression of annates or annual income for various ecclesiastical benefices to a bishop, and indeed some of the income of the pope, while plural benefices were abolished for individual clergymen, so one bishop, one diocese. And this isn't just consistent with the aims of the revolutionary, this is also the consistent of the desires of reforming clergymen, many of who joined the revolutionaries to try and achieve these aims. Moreover, the regional character of France with its individual parliaments was abolished and France was centralized, facilitating a process that had constitutionally begun in earnest nearly 300 years ago during the reign of Francis I, when he established the Generalité in the first place, the old provinces. Despite this initial euphoria, The 19 decrees, which were passed on the 4th of August, were implemented haphazardly, and as of yet, the National Assembly did not have the political machinery or really the authority to realise something as ambitious as the total abolition of feudalism and establishing equality under the law. Rather, the decrees were effectively declarations of intent and subject to continuous revision. The king, on the one hand, had achieved one of his aims in abolishing aspects of the noble privilege that were a hindrance to his fiscal policies, while lamenting that without adequate compensation for the losses for the various estates, such decrees risk dismantling the social order of France. While the peasants no longer pay taxes to the church, those taxes went instead to the state, and often the peasants paid more after the August decrees. The decrees paved the way for the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen. Again, this is draft under the initiative of Lafayette, that claimed social equality in line with the common good, rights of liberty, property, safety, and resistance against oppression for active citizens, whatever that means. In terms of the differentiation in France between active and passive citizen, an active citizen who could engage in a political process was, by the Constitution later defined, as a propertied male above the age of 25. Fundamentally, the power of the National Assembly and the claims of the Third Estate were transmitted into the Declaration that the principle of any sovereignty lies in the nation, not God, let alone his vice-regent, the King of France, whose sovereignty, again supposedly, was confirmed by divine right. The emphasis of national sovereignty, common good, and natural rights bear the indelible marks of the process that had begun really since John Locke, and culminating with the radicalism in terms of its French vein, with Rousseau in terms of the end point of these Enlightenment thinkers. And of course, many of these thinkers are carrying the works of Rousseau, essentially as a revolutionary catechism. Despite these grand strides made by the revolutionaries, negotiations for the nature of France's constitution were ongoing in the court of Versailles, which was rife with interfactional strife. The king from the outset had been reluctant and coerced to become a participant in these decrees, and the precedent had been set in the minds of the revolutionaries that should the king's material and military position improve, the fate of their reforms hanged in the balance. The royalists were keen to have all constitutional deliberations kept away from Paris, which was under the control of the revolutionaries. The idea of the king's veto in particular spooked the revolutionaries. The Palais Royal remained as a rival revolutionary court in Paris, with the idea of claiming that the idea floating around of the king essentially, sorry, I have to repeat that, I'm misreading it. The idea of the king's veto in particular spooked the revolutionaries. The Palais Royal remained as a rival revolutionary court in Paris, and the idea came about of claiming the king after the storming of the Bastille, that unless we have control over the king, we do not have control over the government. The king was barely protected in Versailles, relying on ceremonial units and anticipating his weakness. The king reinforced Versailles with troops of the regular army from the Flanders detachment. As they arrived to declare their fealty to the king, a lavish ceremony was held in the Opera House of Versailles. These claims of what happened that night were exaggerated in the newspaper of Jean-Paul Marat, L'Ami de Pop, which claimed that these soldiers were drunken, gluttonous, and they had desecrated the tricolor cockade, essentially got into a drunken stupor and started around stamping on them. These claims provided the final impetus for the Parisians to strike, although the idea had been floated around as the logical consequence of the storming of the Bastille some months before. Hungry women from all quarters of the marketplace of Paris, armed with makeshift weapons, attacked the Hôtel de Ville in search of food. And this was, again, another fear which had been induced, that of the aristocrats' plot. The idea that food was being deliberately withheld from the city of Paris to starve out the revolutionaries and lessen their morale and ultimately kill them off. So, inspired by this, and of course incredibly hungry, these women attacked the Hôtel de Ville under the command of one Stanislaus and Marie Maillard, and he uses this as a pretext to try and divert the women away from Paris, away from the town hall, with the cry to Versailles. The March on Versailles had the overwhelming support of the National Guard and the backing from various members of the Orléans circle at the Palais Royal. to the extent that Lafayette was powerless to stop the mob, only to be forced reluctantly to head to the march and warn the king in advance. Most quarters were agreed that locking down the king in Paris, placing him under the protection of the guard, would forestall a royalist countercoup and facilitate the smooth formulation of a revolutionary constitution, not to mention the possibility of converting a reluctant king to earnestly embrace the revolutionary cause. At first, the king met a deputation of the women and provided food. In one case, one of the women actually fainted in his presence, assuaging some of the moderate marchers, but many remained, believing that the queen would force the king to renege on any agreement, followed by shouts of "Kill the queen." Of course, this is Marie Antoinette. This is also supposedly where we get the term "let them eat cake," but really it's a mistranslation. Marie Antoinette never said that. A small detachment of protesters entered the palace, entered the queen's quarters, and the queen only narrowly escaped. And this is the depiction in today's thumbnail here. Rather beautiful painting. By now, the Flanders regiment that had been conscripted by the king to defend Versailles were in full retreat, not willing to engage and put down the rebels. Falling on the mercy of Lafayette, who had now arrived in the palace, the royal family appeared on the balcony before the protesters, sating their bloodlust through the family's demonstration of courage and Lafayette's support. And of course, Lafayette is actually shown to be kneeling before the queen, kissing her hand as if to indicate, "My fate and the queen's are intertwined. You can't get to the queen without bypassing me." While bypassing me, and Lafayette at this point still has a revolutionary allure and magnetism, which he won't have in a few years' time. So Lafayette's support was enough to assuage some of the more radical members of the mob who were, again, very close to actually murdering the queen during this time. Nevertheless, Lafayette, despite supporting the monarch, the time of the monarchy in Versailles was over, and instead they were brought effectively interned in the Tuileries Palace. Both d'Orléans and Mirabeau were suspected by the royalists of orchestrating the march. In the case of d'Orléans, he was specifically selected by the hardline royalists around Louis as trying to orchestrate this entire thing to either result in his own dismissal, elimination, and to be replaced as King of France by d'Orléans, which ironically is what happens in 1830 with his brother Charles X. The whole idea of a dynastic struggle mirroring this supposedly revolutionary struggle is something that's on the king's mind. Nevertheless, the direct orchestration of this march by d'Orléans was never proven decisively, albeit it is very likely that his agent provocateurs were there orchestrating various things in the march, and he definitely provided peripheral support to the movement. After this, d'Orléans would join the Breton Club, which would later rename itself unofficially as the Jacobin Club after their meeting place in the Jacobin Monastery. Both Lafayette and Bailly, who received the family in Paris, had now wedded their political futures to the king. Hinging on the success of this new experiment to transform the sovereign King of France, the lord of 25 million subjects, into a revolutionary citizen king of the French people. As ridiculous as that sounds, but nevertheless, they did try it. Just get to here. When, with the king an effective prisoner of the government, the issue of public finances hadn't gone away. Rather, France was effectively bankrupt. Necker had returned to serve the king as prime minister after the Bastille, where his popularity was at its height. In a little over a year, Necker was arrested and banished from France by the National Assembly, who had taken over most financial affairs from the king. Necker's most fierce opponent were the Abbé de Talleyrand, a figure who's going to play a very prominent role later on, and Mirabeau. Marat in particular, the author of L'Ami de Pop, rather the editor, laid the blame on Necker for France's food shortages and involved him in this idea of the aristocrats' plot to intentionally starve people. To resolve this issue, Abbé de Talleyrand proposed in November 1789 to categorize various property as biens nationaux, or goods of the nation. Having already abolished the tithe, the anti-clerical revolutionaries now targeted France's ecclesiastical property, effectively confiscating church land to be seized, auctioned off for sale, to service the debt of France and for any other new financial ventures that the French state may necessarily want to go on. Necker tried to counter this proposal by the suggestion of a national bank, but this proposal failed. Unable to find enough buyers to buy France's clerical holdings quickly enough, the government had to issue bonds known as assignats based on the estimated value of the seized property. The amount of seized property would only increase as the revolution intensified and the flow of emigres out of France increases. Nevertheless, the state's dependence on the assignat would only grow and become far greater than the proportion of confiscated land to become ultimately a worthless paper currency, though the effects of this would only become apparent by 1792 and seriously escalated when France embarks on war with Austria. With the constitutional framing ongoing throughout 1790 and 1791, Lafayette placed himself as France's new revolutionary hero at this orchestrated event to celebrate the first Bastille Day, the Festival of the Federation, Les Fêtes de Fédération, comprising of all the revolutionary federations from the provinces, the National Guard, the National Assembly, during which there was a huge popular feast, and this was essentially an allusion to mark the solidarity of the French nation behind the revolution, to mark the reunification of all the estates into the idea of a national body, that is France, and all in service to the revolution and indeed their king, as if to mark a new era of peace and prosperity. Talleyrand himself officiated over the grand mass of thanksgiving, essentially as the festival's high priest. At the festival, the king declared, "I," and this of course is the origin of Bastille Day, "I, King of the French, swear to use the power given to me by the Constitutional Act of State to maintain the Constitution as decreed by the National Assembly and accepted by myself." So gone are now all the pretenses to King of France. Now we are using the term King of the French by right of the Constitution and the state, as opposed to God or any other higher authority. The king has effectively circumvented all sacred meaning in the monarchy and confined it to this narrow constitutional setting in which he adopts the role of the citizen king. The framing of the Constitution in the aftermath of the fate began to divide the revolutionaries. On some principles, they were all agreed, namely national sovereignty. France's regional system of powers was abolished in early 1790 and replaced with a standardized and centralized system of administration that replaced all the old systems and provinces or généralités. In their place were the départements. These departments were broken up, broke up the older traditional regional identities to emphasize control. So where departments were small enough to be controlled by a single regional center, often that the local government there could ride out and quell any opposition within a single day. Even the old regional names were removed and replaced by geographic features, even in Paris, which became the Department of the Seine. At first, France was now divided into 83 such departments without supposedly any overlaps to these older regional identities or authorities or bodies. The issue of equality, however, was a sticking issue for what would later become the Jacobin movement, or rather the nascent Jacobin movement, who preached for radical equality against the prevailing attitude in the National Assembly, who favoured the representation of property holders and a system of indirect electors. The king was essential to the system in imitation of Great Britain and Montesquieu's own conception of the separation of powers, which indeed was based supposedly off a misreading of our own constitution, whereby the king retained an executive function with the power of veto, but was accountable to the new legislative assembly that would emerge after the National Assembly was superseded in the constitution. In opposition to the Jacobins would later arrive the Filon faction under Barnave, a faction of moderate monarchists who favoured a reserve of powers to appoint ministers, generals and ambassadors, similar to that of Great Britain. Mirabeau had positioned himself as a moderate constitutional monarchist in the aftermath of the Women's March, but died in April of 1791, depriving the moderates of an effective and popular political operator. Indeed, his legacy was thoroughly destroyed after his death and the Jacobins took power. Having already standardized dioceses, abolished the tithe, and confiscated clerical property, the National Assembly passed the Civil Constitution of the Clergy. The Civil Constitution banned monastic orders, introduced elected priests and bishops, while affirming that upon their election, they would take an oath to be loyal to the nation and the king rather than any higher authority. As France was a Catholic nation, this act did not abolish Catholicism in France, but subordinated it entirely to the state, in complete contradistinction to papal oversight and investiture, let alone placing their fate in the nation before that of God. Louis differed on his response to the act and tentatively signed it until hearing from Pope Pius VI that such an act and the oath it entailed separated French Catholics from the church, and as such, Louis XVI was chastised as potentially schismatic. Such a thing had precedent in France when Louis XIV published his four articles of his Declaration of the Clergy, which asserted the rights of the Catholic Church in France and the primacy of monarchical divine right over ultramontanism, i.e. the rights and privileges of the papacy. Though obviously this act, the Civil Constitution of the Clergy, created by a revolutionary government, differed significantly from the more radical earlier incarnations of the French idea of independence of the French Church, Gallicanism, in that national sovereignty was paramount over the Church, and indeed the king, of course the king is mere a vessel, he's a servant, as indeed the Church is. The paramount idea throughout all of this is national sovereignty, the general will, and everything must be subordinated to that. Religion, king, and indeed God has to be submitted to France. The act split the Church in France into jurors, those who supported the new act, and non-jurors, the latter faction being effectively purged by the government, while the former jurors were repudiated by Rome, the schismatic. On the 21st of June 1791, Louis escaped from the Tuileries Palace. Though Louis's aims had proved somewhat unclear, by the summer of 1791, it was apparent that Louis was being forced to sign away his sovereignty, his Bourbon inheritance, while officiating over a regime that increasingly placed him at odds with his Catholic faith, indeed his eternal salvation, leading to the protracted death of the monarchy in France, such as the citizen king was a king in anything but name. Louis needed to reverse the predicament forced upon him after his removal from Versailles. Already, royalist demonstrations had been occurring in Paris, only to be suppressed by the National Guard. Moreover, the safety of his family was a serious consideration after the king was nearly assassinated during the Day of Daggers, after a mob stormed the Tuileries Palace. Louis pinned his hopes on one Marquis de Bouillé. Mutiny was an ever-present concern for royalist officers, especially as the discipline of the royal army was in freefall since before the storming of the Bastille. Bouillé had demonstrated his effectiveness by crushing the mutiny in Nancy in 1790. De Bouillé promised the king that under his protection and from a position of strength, where the people wouldn't need to fear reprisals against the king, the revolution would simply be swept away in a tide of royalist fervour, such as if the last 2 years had effectively been undone. As ridiculous as that might sound, that was the pitch that the king was sold on. However, under the influence of Marie Antoinette, Louis was convinced that royal absolutism could be effectively restored, perhaps with the possibility of a pan-royalist intervention. Their target was Montmédy, a supposedly loyal garrison in close proximity to the Austrian Netherlands. Of course, French garrisons on the border, they could potentially quickly retreat into the Austrian Netherlands, who might in turn support an interventionist army to facilitate in Louis achieving his crown as an absolutist monarch again. Mary and her entourage under Axel von Fersen planned what was ultimately a botched operation, whereby the king made little genuine effort to conceal himself, was recognized and arrested at Varennes before being returned to Paris. With the final framing of the constitution close at hand, Lafayette and the other constitutional monarchists believed that the king's assent to the constitution could remedy the situation, though the flight had radicalized the Cordelier and Jacobin clubs to the point that republicanism was seriously floated as an option for the first time. Lafayette claimed, to little avail, that the king had been kidnapped. The original Republican protest was badly organized, and the Jacobins withdrew their early support from the Cordelier to precipitate a more radical protest to drum up support for a republic. Brissot organized the protest alongside Desmoulins and Danton on the Champ de Mars, where exactly a year before the Festival of the Federation was held. Fearing that the protests had been infiltrated, two people were lynched by the crowd, providing Bailly and Lafayette with a pretext to disperse the crowd, only for the crowd to reassemble and throw stones at the National Guard, who fired into the crowd, killing between 10 and 50 protesters. The action on the Champ de Mars split the revolutionaries definitively. The moderate Jacobins and constitutional monarchists became the aforementioned Fillon group, while the radical Jacobins and the Cordeliers formed a new Jacobin grouping. In the first elections to the French Legislative Assembly, established by the constitution, the centrists and the Fouillon faction won over 80% of the vote. Concurrently with the first constitutional elections, the King of Prussia and the Emperor of Austria pronounced the Declaration of Pillnitz. The failure of the flight and the house arrest of Louis disturbed Marie Antoinette's brother Leopold II of Austria, who invited other European sovereigns to demand the freedom of the king while also responding to the prompting of the French emigres who were there out there influencing the king and petitioning on behalf of Louis XVI's rights. At the time, the great monarchs of Central Europe, be they Russia, Prussia, or Austria, were more concerned with the reinvigoration of Poland and the results of a war with the Ottoman Empire, to the extent that their concern for the safety and liberty of the king served as little more than a footnote to this declaration. Nevertheless, it was enough to radicalize the revolutionaries further by taking their first steps towards expanding the revolution, and doing this first by seizing Avignon from the Pope. The path to war in April of 1792 with Austria followed a similar pattern of securing the revolution through a progressive series of escalations. At first, Paris was secured for the revolutionaries in response to the threat of a second Bartholomew's Day massacre, though securing Paris wasn't enough while the king was at liberty, and so the king needed to be secured for the revolution to succeed. After winning various victories for the French state at the expense of the nobility, the localities, and the church, the king escaped, leading to a further escalation, playing on the fears of the more fervent revolutionaries, since the mass exodus of emigres had led a foreign intervention party, lobbying foreign rulers with only token success as of yet for an invasion. At the same time, the potential loss of the king concerned the constitutional monarchists, who had pinned their prospects to and framed the constitution around his enduring presence, while fearing that an emergent radical faction who could and indeed would ultimately eliminate them in the king's absence. At the same time, the Austrian alliance and marriage were incredibly unpopular and symbolic of France's decline, since her failure in the Seven Years' War was intimately associated with that alliance. Austria and the Holy Roman Empire more broadly was the conventional enemy of France, who possessed many territories which had been object of French desire since at least the reign of Louis XIV. Belgium, what is now Belgium, what was then the Austrian Netherlands, Brabant, and the left bank of the Rhine, not to mention the unsettled question of French sovereignty in Alsace. Increasingly, the notion of the natural boundary of the Gauls had played a part in the neoclassical perceptions of the French Revolutionary Party, especially the Jacobins, as they were about to split into pro-war and pro-peace factions. While war divided the Jacobins, with Brissot, now a Girondin, agitating for it, and Robespierre preaching against it, the war ought to reverse the many humiliations suffered by France in the previous three decades, terminating any last vestige of foreign influence, made France not only greater, but sovereign, her revolution expanded and secured, and her king captured as the citizen king of the French, and not a source of foreign reactionary agitation against the French people. Such was the aim. The French invaded the Austrian Netherlands at Namur, Mons, and Tournai, and completely contrary to this, met with absolute disaster, with two of the French armies defeated and Lafayette forced to retreat. Nevertheless, the Austrian army of the Netherlands was too small to launch an offensive into France, and so the Austrians activated their Prussian alliance, whose army command was quickly given to the Duke of Brunswick as overall Allied commander. Quickly, the Allies bickered over what would become of the second partition of Poland, allowing the French to recover. The Assembly attempted to increase their hold over the king and purge France of potential traitors, namely the non-jura priests, while allowing various priests to be denounced and arrested as traitors on the hearsay of their congregations. The king's own royal guard was removed. The king vetoed the measures against the clergy, though the Frelon faction began to collapse, and the king found insufficient support to maintain his rule. His main ally was Demoy, who was sent to rescue the situation on the front, while Lafayette attempted to mediate the dispute in the Assembly, only to be accused of Caesarism, demonstrating the total collapse of his political influence. And again, it should be noted that one of the fundamental facts which dooms the king, in addition to all of this, everything that had been set up, and of course the aftermath of the flight to Varennes and the radicalization of the revolutionaries, was the king's inability, whilst the regime continued, to win battles. And this also goes hand in hand as to why Lafayette was so humiliatingly humble during this time. The failure of his operation into the Austrian Netherlands, his retreat, and then again his attempt to try and mediate the dispute in the Assembly, and the accusations of Caesarism, all indicate that it's not only the king and his political authority which is waning, but also Lafayette and those who are supporting him. In an attempt, and of course it should be noted that Dumouriez won the Battle of Valmy right at the inception of the French First Republic. Had that battle, say for example, been a few months earlier, there was a chance that the king could have survived. In an attempt to overturn the king's vetoes, Jacobins instigated an insurrection. An armed mob stormed the Tuileries on the 20th of June 1792. Despite the king and the queen being at mercy of the mob, the king refused to overturn his veto power. Unable to intimidate the king, the insurrection collapsed. Lafayette once again came to offer nominal support for the king, who by now recognized Lafayette as political poison and a liability. Moderate Republicans, who had split from the Jacobin movement and were now the pro-war faction, the Girondins, offered to make some form of common cause with the king to be invited in as ministers. However, the king was unwilling to receive their support either. The king was therefore politically isolated. His isolation and unwillingness to make common cause with the war party galvanized republicanism throughout France and intensified fears that the king was waiting for deliverance by foreign powers. As the war continued to go badly for France, the Fédérés, or the war volunteers, joined the army throughout France and passed through Paris on their way to the northern front. The leader of the Cordeliers faction, Georges Danton, exploited the influx of fresh troops to recruit them over to the cause of republicanism, many of whom joined the National Guard, who expanded its membership beyond the artisan sans-culottes, or the petty bourgeoisie. The king, without supporters, without his constitutionally granted bodyguard, and faced with a growing armed radical movement in the capital, was dealt a death blow by the Brunswick Manifesto, a threat of reprisals against the citizenry of Paris should they infringe upon the welfare of the royal family. While Pilnitz had been a tokenistic gesture, the Declaration of Pilnitz, the Brunswick Manifesto was a declaration of intent by a war leader within striking distance of Paris, and indeed, a few days after this, he had invaded France. Though it is difficult to see a scenario in which the monarchy could have survived under these circumstances, the manifesto provided the justification and the support for the Republicans to seize power as they had already intended to do, and indeed were planning on doing so. Danton's revolutionary committee established itself in the Hôtel de Ville to direct the insurrection against the Tuileries and, on the morning of the 10th of August, attacked. The palace was already fortified in anticipation of such an attack and was garrisoned with King's Swiss Guard, who had served the king since the reign of Louis XI. Some elements of the National Guard were also there, and they quickly defected. The king fled rather than defend the Tuileries. Amid the confusion of his order not to resist, the Swiss Guard were massacred by the insurgents. The king and his family were taken under armed guard to beg sanctuary from the Legislative Assembly. From this point on, the monarchy had effectively ceased to exist. And this is the end for the first segment of the three-part series on the French Revolution. I hope everyone enjoyed it. Just to say, for those people who have very kindly sent super chats this evening, that there will be a discussion portion and a reading of the super chats on Saturday after I complete my lecture on Napoleonic France. So please come back then and I will read your super chats and I will answer your questions to the best of my ability. Other than that, it just so happens that there's been a bit of a spontaneous coincidence. I think this is more to do with the fact that today is Bastille Day rather than anything else. But Radlib is hosting a discussion on the war in the Vendée, and there's also going to be a bit of overlap here because we'll be discussing the war in the Vendée tomorrow as well, but obviously not in as much detail, I'm sure, as Radlib. And I think Panama Hat and Turnip will also be there as well. So everyone go and check out that channel and subscribe to Radical Liberation and watch that discussion on the war in the Vendée. And I will see you tomorrow at 9 p.m. to discuss terror and virtue and terror, the reign of terror in France, the Jacobin ascendancy, their rise and their fall. Good night, everyone.